it does come down to people at the end of the day. People are the variable, and people follow people. They're inspired by people. People quit people, you know, and they don't quit companies, they quit people. And so I feel like that really, you know, sort of adoption of investing in the right people is critical. So I can't stress that enough.
Welcome to the Creative Agency Account Manager Podcast. I'm Jenny Plant, and I'm on a mission to help account managers understand the agency business and develop an entrepreneurial mindset in their role so they can show up as a commercially aware advisor to their clients rather than a reactive order taker. Hello and welcome to episode 113. Today's guest will be particularly inspirational for you if you are currently a small agency owner with aspirations for huge growth. Jared Lopiccolo built his agency from a single laptop to a multi-million dollar agency. He shares some insight into what it took to achieve that growth and also his advice for other agency owners who may want to do the same thing. So we talk about a range of things. He shares the pivotal moments that were the growth accelerator points in his business, how you need to change and adapt as a leader, how to build a strong culture of very engaged employees, and also some of the trends he's seeing in the agency landscape and how he thinks agencies need to adapt to what's coming. He shares so many more tips and insights into running the business. So I think you're going to have a lot to come away with. Let's go to the introduction now. Today, I'm absolutely delighted to welcome Jared Lopiccolo. He is the CEO and founder of Noble Studios, a creative digital performance marketing agency based in Reno, Nevada and Bristol, UK. Over the last two decades, Jared has grown Noble Studios from a single laptop endeavor to an international company. And Noble's impressive client list includes the likes of Google, Visa, Disney, Adobe, and Visit Lake Tahoe. So I'm delighted to get into the questions. Welcome, Jared.
Jenny, thank you for having me. I'm really excited about today and what I can share. And hopefully you throw me some curveball questions and we make it a little fun. But yeah, thanks for having me.
Honestly, it's delightful to have you. And I'm really looking forward to getting into these questions because to have built the company to what it is today from where you started is pretty phenomenal. So the first question I've got for you is, looking back on your journey, what were the key magnifying moments that helped you grow your business from a laptop to a multi-million dollar business?
Yeah, I think a lot of, you know, assuming you're an agency listening, I think a lot of agencies, you start an agency because you have an amazing craft and you want to share that with the world and you see a demand and therefore you want to fill it. I think one of the things that we really subscribed to was building a sales team, like a focused sales team that was always on, right? It was always out there selling. Whereas a lot of the business comes through the partners and the relationships that the partners have. And that was allowing us to scale, I think, creating the name Noble, right, as well, like having it not be an agency's person's name, you know, that creates an element of detachment. And instead, then you have to lead with sort of core values. But I definitely feel like, you know, really having that sales engine sort of always on, you know, there was a line out the door at those early stages, like continuing to keep that line out the door. So that was probably one of them. I think the other one was really subscribing to the idea of hiring smarter people than you. That's a really tough thing for leaders and, you know, and entrepreneurs, that we assume that we know how to do this better than anybody else. And you might in that very short moment of time, but if you're thinking you're going to play the long game, you know, really you need to hire smarter, better people than you. And then in order to grow truly into like growing a more scalable multi-million dollar type company, you've got to move from being a tradesperson, you know, to a business person. And I didn't go to school for business. I went to school for architecture and design. And just like many of us that start agencies, you know, we have this craft that we want to share with the world. It's not that we usually start an agency when you've gone to, say, for instance, business school. And so I'm reminded by this one moment, and we all have this moment where we have to choose sort of family or business, right? We're caught in the crosshairs, the crossfires of that. And it was December 5th. It was 2008. It was a Friday night. And it was the moment where we have what's called a tree lighting ceremony. And that means Santa Claus comes down you know, the main drag in our small little town. And as he comes down and, you know, the lights start coming on and then they light the whole city and everyone comes to gather in the main courtyard of the Capitol building. And we had this deadline for a really, really large Fortune 100 client. Just happened to be at 5 o'clock on a Friday deadline. Don't do that ever, by the way. Like, always never have deadlines at Fridays at five. But my wife shows up, who's a business partner, and she shows up with our two kids, 5 years old, 3 years old, in the office. My team's working late. And I look to her and I say, I'm not going to be able to make it. You know, we've got this deadline for this massive company. And she, you know, silently just turned around and walked out. And I just sat there sort of with my heart in my hands, you know, like, what am I doing? I have to make. And then the team swiveled their chairs, you know, and they said, Jared, we've got this. Like, go, like, let it go, you know. And I did. I had to put it out. I just let it go. And I ran across the street because we were downtown near the Capitol. I ran across the street and met with my family right when the lights came on. And it was this celebratory moment of like, yes, okay, I chose family, you know, over business in that moment. And but it was really about this idea of, you know, letting it go and, you know, delegating. And so ever since then, that was one of the pivotal moments of transitioning from a tradesperson to a business person. We started creating frameworks. And when you think about delegation, you really have that framework of like, okay, the team readiness is on one side, and then you have the level of importance or tasks on the other side. And if the team readiness is low and the important task is high, you can't delegate. You have to monitor and you have to coach through that moment. But if their team readiness is super high and the importance is maybe even high or low, you can probably delegate and they'll do a job better than you over time. And so I think that was the first defining real moment where me as an entrepreneur, a leader, I had to let go, trust that the team would do it, chose family over business, and it worked, you know. And a lot of us have those stories where, you know, we've chosen, you know, business over family. And you'll never remember the moments that you miss in business, but you'll always remember those moments that you miss with family.
Oh, that is such a good story. Love it. Okay, so much to dive into this because I'm thinking I'm an agency owner and maybe I'm doing the sales at the moment at this stage in my business. And did you hire someone even though you couldn't afford it who was dedicated to sales? Like, what went through your mind thinking you obviously prioritized sales, which I think everyone's going to agree that that was a very smart move. We've always got to focus on the pipeline. But at what point do you hire someone for sales? Because could you afford it? Like, where were you at that point?
Yeah. And this is that leap of faith that you have to take, right? When you think you're ready, it's like when you buy a house and you're like, well, I barely afforded that at the time. You stretched yourself to the limit. And if anyone's listening and can relate, I would go out and I would hunt for the business. And then I would secure the business and I'd bring it back, right? And then I would be part of harvesting that business. You know, I would be the one either helping carry the business over the line, or I would have some contributing role to completing that product or service or experience. And it was just that we call it the roller coaster ride. You know, when you're high, it's because you just landed a bunch of business. And when you're low, it's because you have no business available. And so we looked for a partner who could be our, you know, chief client officer. And we found one. And of course, back in the day, we used to say this person had a large Rolodex, you know, and now we have to say LinkedIn following or whatever else. But we were, in negotiations and we thought this is perfect. This person wants to work for us. We want them that we're going to, you know, do really well. And they asked us, he said, can you afford my salary? Right. Cause we're a small, and I said, absolutely, for 3 months, you know, that's it. So you got to put your neck out there too, right? Get your head a little bit above the skis and you got to close some business. And it was just great. And I didn't just send this person out into the wild on their own. We partnered up, and actually for about 3 or 4 years, you know, we were linked arms together, going to business meetings together, you know, closing, kind of playing good cop, bad cop, like really kind of, and then I could start to back out, right? All of a sudden, once that person knew our company and knew how to sell the services and present our brand, you know, and those things, I could actually start letting go a bit and backing off. But yeah, we couldn't afford that person. No.
No, but that was a smart move as well, because you were almost mentoring him until you felt he was ready, which I'm just thinking that might be a different way of thinking about it for some people listening, thinking they have to hire someone and then step away straight away.
And they do. And oftentimes you hear it never works. It fails. I tried that. It doesn't work. And it's like, well, you didn't invest then. You didn't really set that person up for success or train them on the ways that you would attract business or, you know, fulfill on writing contracts or getting team buy-in when you're doing the scoping or whatever the case is. And so you really got to walk the walk with that person.
How did you make that hiring decision, Jared? Because obviously that was a key person for you in the early days. What was it about him that stood out for you?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. You always want to ask, you know, for advice. And so I asked the community that I knew in the business community. I had a few board of advisors at the time, kind of expressing the problems we had, that we wanted to grow. I'm a bottleneck, right? We're only going to grow to my capacity. And they had said, you know, there's a few people in market. I asked for those introductions. So it was a really like warm introduction. We had common, you know, relationships. So when I met this person, you know, we actually kind of already knew each other. He was sitting on a board for an economic development for the region. I was on another board that was economic development. So we had some proximity to each other and some understanding of each other, but it really did come down to a recommendation. And then we actually, I had those board of advisors vet and ask that person questions, and they were able to ask the board of advisor question, very raw questions like, look, I'm gonna bet a lot of my career to go to this small agency. What do you think about that? And they were able to confirm that, no, we are strong leaders. We are good people. And so I think there's a lot, I think oftentimes we don't realize that we don't need to go and find a headhunter or, you know, a recruiter, that there's someone that's in our network, but we just got to look and try to find that person.
Great tip. Final question on him specifically, yeah. Because, you know, like, what level of experience did he have? From what you're saying, it sounds like he was super experienced.
No, in fact, he had almost zero agency experience, but he had a lot of marketing experience. So he was a chief marketing officer at another industry and firm in a private market. But so he had to come up. There was a learning curve for him to understand, how do we sell and price web services or campaign services or brand services and whatnot. But the parts that we didn't have to teach was him being able to, you know, create connections and, you know, understand the sales funnel and the model and stuff. So I think you can have either industry experience, you can have service experience. I think you can have skill set type experience, and you're never going to find all of those at once that's going to fit your business. That's a unicorn. You can maybe create a unicorn, and then when they leave, you know, they leave as unicorns, but maybe they come in as like chubby rhinos, you know?
Yeah, I like that. The other thing you said was always hire people smarter than you.
Yes.
Again, I'm getting a bit granular, but I'm just trying to make it really actionable for someone listening to this. If you're hiring someone smarter than you, do you feel confident evaluating their skill set? Are you necessarily best placed to ask them the right questions? Like, give me your thoughts on that.
Yeah, you know, I think each one of us is an expert in our own area. And I feel that, you know, I'm an entrepreneur. And so that type of a role, a lot of people don't want, right? A lot of people don't want that stress or want, you know, that duality of both personal and business life mixing together in a blender. And so I think it's okay to, you know, ask questions of people that are smarter than you and be curious. And I think a lot of people don't feel like they feel like they have to have all the answers, and that, and if they don't have that, or, you know, if someone maybe is smarter than them, they might see them as a threat. But realizing on the other end of the table, that person's looking at you and saying, I don't know all the answers and how they operate and what keeps them up at night and how they've formed their expertise. And so I think it's a matter of being curious, you know, asking questions, having the confidence that if you attract people that, you know, are leading with compassion and, you know, and have similar sort of ethos, then their skill set level, it can be 0 to 10, and they could be on the 10 and you're on the 6, and it won't matter, because you're still sort of fighting the common goal of the vision and mission of the company and such. So I would say, you know, yeah, who cares if they're smarter than you? You're smarter than them in a lot of other areas, and just stay curious and ask a lot of questions, and you'll find out if that person's the right fit or not.
Yeah, it's interesting, because some of the most successful entrepreneurs that I've ever met are curious, charismatic, empathetic, and they're just magnetic, I think. And that's why, you know, you're not trying to be the smartest person in the room. And that's actually what endears you to people. And that's why people want to work for you. I think that you have to have that mix. Do you agree?
I do. I think it's about being relatable. And I feel like when you sort of put yourself in that ivory tower, and, you know, then all of a sudden you're no longer relatable, unless someone, you know, you're looking across the valley and another person in an ivory tower. And I feel like take all the steps all the way down and meet with any person. And, you know, you never know where wisdom is going to come from. And so that's that part of staying curious. And, you know, at the end of the day too, we all live the same life, right? We all have to put our pants on one leg at a time, you know? So at the end of the day, we're all the same, and to treat each other that way. And that kind of, you know, that kind of gives that confidence to approach any kind of person or situation, you know, with the lack of fear.
Absolutely. Love that. The final thing you said in terms of the success trifecta was you had to learn a lot more about business. You weren't schooled in business. You didn't go to business school or anything. If someone's listening to this thinking, oh, I probably need some myself, what would be your kind of shortcut suggestions or tips?
Well, and So you either learn by sort of formal education of business, or you learn through what I would call like a volume of experience. And as entrepreneurs or leaders, we have a tendency to say yes, you know, to everything, right? To say, yes, of course, yeah, we do that. Yeah, we've never done that before. We're going to figure it out. And I think that's an important quality at the beginning to sort of test the demand and test the kinds of clients and the kinds of people and such. But then I think you have to develop that muscle around saying no, right? And at the end, by saying no, you'll actually service the business better and the people that work for you better. And so I feel like that is something that maybe, you know, as a life lesson or learn, you know, if I were to do this again, and I would probably institute saying no a little quicker. But at the same time, you know, I'm here where I am today because of saying yes and all those lessons. But, you know, you learn through that, right? You learn through saying no. And I will say that one thing in that same theme of saying no is that we created sort of like a mantra of no assholes, right? And that means we don't want to hire assholes. We don't want to work with assholes. And I know those that are listening, you probably think, maybe you don't call them an asshole, right? That's not fair. But maybe there's someone that's grouchy all the time, but they do the work of three people. Or maybe you have a really, you know, sexy client. Everyone loves the brand, but they don't like you. They treat you unfairly, or they don't speak to you like a real human, you know? And so I think that's one of those things too, like probably would have established the sort of no asshole clause, if you will, a little earlier. And actually, funny enough, we actually wrote it into our MSA in the early days. Now it's still in there, but it's no longer called that. It's about inclusivity and, you know, and treating each other equal, and, you know, and that we're always going to have a conversation if there's, you know, a debate and, you know, things like that. And we'll look for resolution. But yeah, we instituted that early on. And then I guess the other last thing I would say is it's really important to establish a framework, right? A framework that can hold you accountable in your business. So it's outside of having a vision and a mission and those sort of things. It's really about a framework that keeps you accountable. It establishes the discipline. It allows you to put things in place that you want to measure. And at the end of the day, what you measure is what you improve.
Tell me more about that framework, because I've had several conversations in the last couple of weeks with owners who actually want to see from their team a certain type of behavior. What specifically is in that framework, or how do you launch that framework? What does that kind of framework look like and
do? So similar to like, if you want to improve your own health, you're going to hire a trainer, and that trainer is going to say, well, what do you want to work on? You're going to say, oh, I want to run a marathon. Then they're going to say, okay, I'm going to design a very specific training, you know, curriculum that's going to fit what your end desire is. And it could be any kind of trainer, right? At the end, but the real results are in your consistency. So I always say consistency outbeats strategy every single day. So going back to the question framework, we subscribe to Traction. And those that are out there listening, it's an entrepreneurial operating system. No, I'm not getting paid to say this out loud, but I was a little resistant at first because I thought, I don't want to be this purist and, you know, really subscribe to this thing and, you know, be just, you know, like dogged about every single day. But what I found is the more that you're consistent with whatever framework it is, so meeting on Wednesdays at 8:55 and we end at 9:55, we talk about the same agenda. We solve problems the same way. We score the meeting. Is it a healthy meeting? If not, how do we improve the meeting next time? We meet on a monthly basis, you know, in terms of our partners, and we go offsite and we follow the same structure of identifying and discussing and solving problems. We meet on a quarterly basis with our management team, and it's always 2 days offsite, you know, so we're, because it takes about a half a day to just get warmed up to solving problems and working on the business as opposed to working in the business. And we ask, is our vision still appropriate? Is our 3-year target still appropriate? Is our 10-year goal still appropriate? What are our quarterly goals that we're all working on? So it's all this stuff just creates that discipline. And so whatever framework you subscribe to, it really won't matter. What matters is your consistency in adopting it and that accountability that it creates to hold you to it.
Love that. What other learning moments did you have? You mentioned saying no. You mentioned having sort of accountability frameworks. What else would you say was key points where it was like a challenge that you overcame or a learning moment that you had?
Yeah, I think it does come down to people at the end of the day. People are the variable, and people follow people. They're inspired by people. People quit people, you know, and they don't quit companies, they quit people. And so I feel like that really, you know, sort of adoption of investing in the right people is critical. So I can't stress that enough. Like someone leaves a company and they're like, we've got to fill that role immediately. And then they fill it with, you know, a shiny object and they didn't do the due diligence. And so we have a rigorous like screening process, and we interview them based on our core principles and values, You know, we ask them to align, what value or principle do you align with most? You know, we give them homework assignments that are relative to the role that we're looking to bring them in, so we can truly see how they would operate in a sort of mock project or a mock scenario. And then once they're on board, then we have this really rigorous 90-day onboarding plan where almost every day is mapped out, or at least, you know, as you get closer to those 90 days, this gets a little softer, but they really know what success looks like after 90 days. And then we do a nice interview of like, okay, tell us how we as Noble Studios can be better from your experience. Yeah, right. You've come into this company, you only have one view into the company, one impression. Tell us what that impression is and how can we be better? And then we say, great, well, here's what we've noticed, our impression of you, and here's how we think you can be better. And so I go back to like, if you get the right people on the bus, the whole Jim Collins thing, and you get them and the wrong ones off the bus, and then you get them in the right seats, I'll tell you that learning lesson of just bringing all the right people together, you can pivot any service, you can go into any geo, you can adjust and go after any industry with a lot of confidence because you have the right people and they're the ones that are going to carry it over the line.
Oh my gosh, that is so good. So full of tips. The 90-day onboarding for a staff member sounds very, very thorough. And you're probably one of the only agencies I've ever heard to say that it's actually mapped out daily. How long did that take you to develop? Who did that for you? Did you do that yourself? Talk to me about that process.
Yeah, you know, it starts with subscribing to the concept that, you know, we could be better every day, right? That's our strap line. It's let's be better every day. It's an internal sort of organizing thought, and it's a challenge to our team. You can be better. And it's an external invitation for our clients to be better as well. So we ask for that feedback. And what we found 10 years ago or so is that people sometimes said, gosh, I felt like an island, you know, coming on board. And we were using the work product to, you know, give them that experience or give them that exposure. And so we'd ask them time and time again, well, what could we do to be better? Well, it would have been great to shadow clients a little earlier and get exposed to them. You know, okay, great. You know, that's now in the onboarding plan. It would have been great to have met with all those department leaders because I really didn't know what this department did over that department. Okay, great. Now that's built in. You're going to meet with all the department leaders. And, or, you know, it'd been great, Jared, if I understood what the origins of Noble story was. I never knew that you both started in a bedroom with a laptop and no money and debt free. And okay, and then that builds a connection with them earlier. Oh, well, that's going to be part of the onboarding. You're going to have a one-on-one with the CEO and I'm going to tell you all about the origin stories. And so it starts with feedback and being curious and asking how we could be better. And that then built out this really robust, you know, onboarding plan. And then I think we're still getting the feedback like, hey, how could we be better? No, it's too good, you know, and maybe tone it down a little, you know, yeah. You've maybe over prescribed a little and stuff. So it's always a constant work in progress, but it does start truly with asking that, how can we be better? And then taking that feedback in and doing something with it.
Love that. I've had the pleasure of meeting your team and I am working with your team and I am blown away by how self-motivated they are, how positive they are, how energetic they are. So what's your secret to creating this culture where you have so many engaged people?
I think it starts at the very top, but you need to have really strong brand ethos, right? You have to have a mission that people want to be with. Like, where are we going, right? Then you have to have this, you know, this strong core values and principles that they align with, that they're like, those are the same principles that I carry. And you model that behavior. And by doing that, it makes it a safe environment and people can unlock the best versions of themselves. And I also, you know, I oftentimes say, I want our team or our partners or our clients or our stakeholders, I want them to steal the dinner conversation. And what that really means is I want them to be so darn passionate about what they do that they're sucking all the oxygen out of the room without realizing it. And then they say, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry, I didn't mean to. But it's because they're leading with so much passion, right? And so I think that there's that element. I talked about the let's be better every day of that invitation. Part of that, though, is also making it very safe for the team to give kind, not nice feedback. And so, you know, I get that on the daily. I ask for it all the time. Like, all right, give me some kind, not nice feedback. That allows me to bend my knees and receive it. And it's going to be delivered in a positive way. It allows me to also ask for invitation to give feedback to others. And so that I think helps create that culture. But I think that probably the number one thing is, and I'm a little obsessive about this, but it has to do with meaningful connections. And it's building sort of these deep, authentic relationships. And I always oftentimes say, like, you know, when you meet someone, imagine if that's the last person that you'll ever meet, right? Wow. How do you want to show up, right? How do you want to influence? How do you want to make a friend, right? And you do that by listening and by inspiring, talking and relating and finding some sort of common thread. And I think this is lacking today, right? And it's compounded by a pandemic and by us watching Netflix series all the time and us remote working, social media, and just the endless scrolling, like all those things kind of remove us from having deep, meaningful connections. Instead, we have these sort of surface relationships. And just about 2 months ago, I read this article from Wall Street Journal, and it said one in four Americans, 25% are lonely and they're on the verge of depression and they don't have someone they can confide in. And they don't have someone they consider to be a really strong connection, a strong friend, that social, that deep, meaningful connection. But then, on the other side, I read just last month, March 8th, 2024, Stanford University released a study. They said that, if you have strong social connections, right, these deeper, meaningful, connected relationships, you're actually likely going to extend those by 50% in terms of time. So think of, team members or clients, you build those relationships, they're going to extend that you're going to have a longer retention rate if you want to measure it. But then on the personal side, it actually reduces stress. It reduces inflammation. It reduces anxiety. It increases empathy and sympathy. And they even have this study that shows that it allows you to recover from disease faster and could even extend your life. And you think, my gosh, just by being a good, positive human and finding a connection, you can make the world better and you can extend life. And so I think about that. And I think those that have practiced that in history, like famous people, I think of Martin Luther King and, back to people follow people and are inspired. He said, I have a dream. He didn't say I have a plan. Right. So he led with his heart, and that's what drew people together. And he bonded with people on an authentic level. And so I would say that, that's probably our secret sauce, is really just giving a shit about people.
Oh, my goodness. It's just so profound. And I wanted to ask you, said, one of the reasons it isn't happening and we're falling into that one in four depressed state is pandemic, remote working, social media. Do you also think it's texting rather than talking?
100%. It's that strong reliance on technology. I mean, even my kids, right? I have a 20 and a 17-year-old, and it's not their fault, but they are sitting there, they're telling, I can't get a hold of this. Like, I tried texting, I tried, emailing. I even went, I'm like, did you just try calling?
Yeah.
And all of a sudden they called, they're like, oh my gosh, they answered it and it's all resolved. And I'm like, yeah. And so I think there's this fear, and I believe it or not, I'm an extrovert, but I've got to warm up to be in front of crowds or audiences or, put myself out there just as much as an introvert would. But I know once everyone does have human to human connection, everyone walks away. No one walks away feeling like, well, that was a bad idea to do that. If anything, they're energized. Maybe they're exhausted and they need to take a break and they're, oh my gosh, my adrenaline was rushing. But no, it's like going to the gym. No one walks away from the gym saying, I wish I would have never done that today.
So true. I think I'm with you because I started working in the early 90s and I sound so dinosaur-like, but we didn't even have the internet. So There was no chance. We didn't have mobile phones. You had to pick up the phone every time you spoke to your client. There was no way about it. So I kind of think in part, for some people, it's a muscle building thing, getting in the habit of having those conversations. And going back to your thoughts, Jared, because this has been brilliant even so far, I'm really interested in hearing your thoughts on the market for agencies at the moment. Like, what have you seen changing and do you think is likely to change?
Yeah. Well, so it's interesting. When you think about agency life, you usually have this Mad Men picture, of working late and solving problems and the sort of Google-esque version of ping pong tables and this. And I think it goes back to we're just passionate creatures, right? We want to solve problems and we don't think of ourselves solving problems, at 8 in the morning till 10 in the morning. And that's when I'm going to be the most creative. And so I think the pressure that I'm seeing, and this is maybe compounded by the pandemic and everyone having to absorb both personal and business into their own homes. And, and that's tough. That's not for everyone. I mean, that's been my life this entire time. And so I'm used to it and knowing how to find boundaries and stuff. But I think there's this trend that I'm seeing, which is very much 40-hour work week, and that's it. And I'm not saying I want people to work 60-hour work weeks, but I think about a Michelin star restaurant and they're not thinking about that. They're thinking about the next dish that they want to create and that they're going to get invited to the James Beard Foundation and that they're going to get surveyed and their heart is in it, you know, and, or like if you're a band or if you're a rocket scientist, you know, you're not thinking about, well, I can only put in 8 hours today as I'm, you know, building this new technology to take humanity to Mars. You're solving a mission. And I feel like there's this like pendulum swing that said, oh no, if it's over 40 hours, you're abusing employees. And it's like, no. Like, you know, they're choosing to wake up on a Saturday on a hike and the light bulb comes on and they sit down and they want to get that idea out. And so I feel like, you know, that is definitely a lot of pressure on agencies. And through that, what you're seeing is people don't want to be defined by their business life. And I just think that's bullshit. I just think, why would you not want to be defined by what you do for a living, that, you know, how you're contributing economically to the world? Otherwise, you're substanceless. You know, you're just, oh, I got seven cats, you know, and I, you know, I love Taco Tuesday. And it's like, there's more for you than that. And so I feel like it's okay to be defined by both your business life and your personal life. And that becomes your own brand. And to celebrate that. And if you don't want to be defined at all by your business life, you're probably not in the industry that you want to be in, because I don't see it as work. I see it as like a life, you know, fulfillment or a mission or a project or a quarterly goal that I'm working on. And it's an investment and I enjoy what I do. And so I would say if anybody just sees it as a job, as I call it, as opposed to a career and a way of like, you know, really defining yourself and allowing you to bring your entire self to work, you should probably get out of that and move into a different industry and work for UPS or FedEx or, you know, something like that.
So you think the reason that's happening is because maybe people have chosen the agency life and shouldn't really be in it. You need to be in it and really it's part of your career path rather than this is just a job on the side that I do.
Yeah, I think marketing, you know, at the end of the day, we're either creators or we're consumers. And I think that 20 years ago, a lot of people were just effectively, you know, they're creators, but not on the marketing side so much. And now everyone, you know, you turn around, you're an influencer, or you work for this company, you do marketing this way or the other. And so I think you can take marketing out of an agency now and you can do it in-house, which wasn't really the case. You're starting to see a lot more of that. And then those businesses where you work for a private market, you know, company and you're in marketing, you can work those 8 to 5. So I think that's driving it. But those that want to really like, you know, solve problems. I mean, we operate on a 30% learning curve every year because of all the different problems we have to solve and the clients that come with unique challenges and that volume, right? You've got to be a special person to want to solve that kind of volume of problems. Conversely, what I hear is someone goes into the private side, they love the stability and then, after 2 years, they're bored as hell. And they're like, mm-hmm. Get me out of here. I need more energy. This is moving too slow. There's too much bureaucracy and da, da, da. So I think it's finding that balance of both work, life, play, and bringing your whole self to work and such. But yeah, agencies definitely it's a different kind of breed to work in an agency world.
It's so true. What are you seeing from client side? What are the clients demanding on you now that perhaps they weren't demanding on you 20 years ago? How have you seen that relationship change?
Yeah, I think that, you know, what I appreciate this, that clients are more educated around marketing these days than ever because they're also on LinkedIn and then Instagram. And it's the same person, right? Going back and forth, not just this only business people on LinkedIn and only this education that the client has now. So what you have to do is you got to meet them where they're at, right? And then really partner with them. And that's always been our mantra, is to kind of like lock arms and let's do this together. But if you think about the old days of ad industries, the client would give you all the feedback and you'd go away and you'd come back with the same exact creative and you would take none of the feedback in and you would just shoot it all down. And I don't think that's fair because I think clients, they know their product sometimes better than we'll ever know it. And so I think that partnership is critical. And I think clients are demanding that more without really saying it. They're demanding that more. And then the last thing I would say is with clients, you really got to measure everything you do today. So you can't just like chalk it up as brand awareness. You need to show that brand awareness actually affected product purchases or demos downloaded or experiences made. So you've got to really like focus on the conversion side. And I think speaking the conversion language of your clients. So if it's like we landed this number of customers or we did this number of demos, say in the B2B space or in the travel and tourism space, we have to talk about heads to beds. So occupancy rate of hotels. And we have to talk about, you know, ADR, average daily rates that, you know, visitors will spend in market. Those are what we're held to when we talk about measurements, not we sent this number of visitors to your website, or you had this number of likes or this number of comments, you know, so really owning the client's objectives and business problems and sort of staying up late at night on the things that they're worrying about as well.
I think that's great advice. Solving business outcomes for clients. What are the outcomes they want to achieve and talking their language? Love that. Anything else that you're seeing is changing with clients?
I think because of their increased knowledge around marketing, the fact that they have internal teams. I'm definitely seeing an adoption of AI on the client side, and I encourage it, right? So I want to state that, by, I mean, we are running at AI faster than any agency I know, but only to see it as a tool and as a brainstorming buddy. But we still need that human element. Like, the human element is so critical. And I mentioned earlier, this volume of experience that you get as it being in whatever industry you're in. Well, for us, we see thousands of campaigns and hundreds of brand strategies. And so what happens is that the polish that comes out of these AI tools, the client just assumes that it's better than what they could have created. But the reality is like, it's also inaccurately in at times giving you like beautiful things, but they're not actually appropriate. Or maybe it sounds good, but when you stress test it with real humans, it falls flat on its face. So I think there's a challenge of like, adopting AI and considering it to be like, that's perfect because it's this polished, you know, really nice look and feel, as opposed to leaning on the experience of those that have like seen this, because we all can get a little hoodwinked, if you will, and enamored by the shiny object. And right now AI is one of those shiny objects. So we're seeing clients adopt it at a pretty accelerated rate.
Amazing. And are you seeing that clients are generally having AI policies that you need to sign up to, or are you creating your own AI policy that you share with clients? Is there any specifics you can share around that kind of exchange?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that. It's actually a really important sort of underbelly that nobody really talks about. But, you know, because at the time of wanting to adopt AI, it's like, I have a belief that, like, run at it as fast as you can. But let's also look at what field we're playing in. And so, you know, we've worked right away at the very beginning of the days. We created an AI sort of point of view, like how we're going to leverage AI, how we're going to communicate with that we're using AI, how it's going to make our work product better, but not replace the human element side. And that we'll, you know, we'll never, in fact, we'll hire in more people and not lose jobs because of it. But we brought in our legal counsel and we looked at every single AI tool and we looked at their terms and use. And we built a matrix of those and we keep it. It's a living document. It gets updated on a monthly basis. We have an AI task force that meets with our legal counsel and makes sure that when we're using AI tools or products that go into market, and it's not just assisted, but it's also generated AI, that our team is communicating that effectively to our clients. Now, what I'm not seeing yet, I'm not seeing our clients adopt a lot of AI policy and stuff. So it's refreshing when we come to the table and say, well, you know, if we're going to use Midjourney, let's just be clear that they have a gallery and it sits in their gallery and others can find that content, and but you're okay because it's only a 3-month campaign and it's short lived. You're never going to use it again. Great. Let's do this. Or, oh, you want that to be part of your campaign for life? Well, I'm not going to recommend we use Midjourney. We'll maybe use it for brainstorming, but then the actual final output is going to be fully human generated. And so that level of confidence and communication, I think, is critical. And it's just tough. I mean, what we knew about AI a year ago to what we know now is vastly different. And so we're just constantly leaning into it and we're doing monthly updates and doing, you know, show and tells with our team on a monthly basis of what we created with it and how it was communicated. And it's exciting. I mean, it's a new tool. And again, I don't subscribe to that it's going to replace people. There's more humans on this planet than there ever has been and more people are employed than there ever has been. So why would that trend not continue just because we create smarter tools? So.
Absolutely. And that's really good advice, actually. Getting some legal counsel, I think, is super smart. I interviewed Sharon Torek. Do you know Sharon?
She's from
Torek Law. She's at the forefront. She's a lawyer. She has a lawyer firm. And she's specifically in AI consultancy with agencies. And she said essentially that, you know, you've got to look at the AI tools and read their terms when it comes to copyright, ownership, etc. Because she said, whilst I haven't seen any cases yet, I'm expecting them to come, legal cases as a result. So I think it's super smart to build in legal counsel early while you're formulating policy. So some great tips there. Jared, I'm conscious of your time. Do you have any final kind of tips for anyone that is maybe on that agency owner journey and, you know, it wants to avoid some of the pitfalls? Anything that you haven't shared that you think might be useful?
I would say, you know, we talked about being curious earlier. I think not just about being curious, but being vulnerable and actually asking for advice. You know, people feel like they have to have all the answers. And if they don't, then they don't look as intelligent as they should, or maybe they should have that. And I just say, you know, what the hell? Like, put yourself out there. Nobody knows everything. So, and oftentimes when you ask for advice, you get money, aka you get opportunities. But if you ask for money or opportunities, you usually get advice, you know. So leading with asking for advice, you usually get a higher return. And then one of those things we did outside of when we grow the business and look for partnerships and those kinds of things and asking for that advice. But we do it with our team members, and anyone can do this, whether you're an agency or anyone else's. We do weekly surveys of our team members and we ask 7 questions. It takes less than 30 seconds to fill out. It's a rating from 0 to 7. On a quarterly basis, we get commentary and feedback that comes through, but on a weekly basis, we're just having them quickly score. And it's anything from like, you know, do I feel valued at work, or is my workload, you know, too much? Do I have the proper equipment to do my job? Am I pay and benefits what I expect them to be? On the benefit side, how's your vacation time, or what we call PTO here in the States? And getting that feedback is so critical, because it's not just about listening. It's about then taking it and putting it into action and communicating that you've heard what those issues are, and that this is what you're working to do to resolve those issues. And it doesn't have to be an immediate fix. It can be that, look, we're talking at the senior leadership level and we're going to be creating this thing. And then when you actually make the announcement that we've heard you and here's the new solution to it, that loyalty that gets created within your staff is just critical. So you can do that, of course, on the client side through like a net promoter survey or a quarterly survey or whatever you want to call it. But I think getting advice and getting feedback is probably the most critical thing, and it's going to get you faster to where you want to go.
Great words of advice. Thank you so much. Jared, this has been amazing. Thank you so much for sharing so many tips and valuable insights. Final question, who would you like to be contacted by? If anyone's listening to this, and it could be anyone, I mean, you don't know who's going to be listening. Who would you like to be contacted by, and what's the best way to reach you?
Yeah. So we're obviously an agency and we work in, you know, creative digital and performance marketing. I would say that if you are a brand and you've got a small marketing team, you've got some pretty lofty, heavy goals that you want to get to, go to our website, noblestudios.com. It's NOBLESTUDOS.com. You can check out case studies. You can see the kind of caliber of work that we do, and then give us a ring, right? So we have a contact form. You can do that, or even hit me up on LinkedIn. You can find me, Jared Lopiccolo. It's JarrodLopiccolo. I know that's a tongue twister, but Jared Lopiccolo, and just direct message me. I always love to talk to anyone. I just say, don't sell me shit on the first call. You know, we can always, you can always sell me on the second, third call, but let's just have a human to human connection. So
thank you so much, Jared. This has been amazing. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Jenny. Appreciate you.
I hope you enjoyed my chat with Jared, and you can follow him on LinkedIn. He shares insights over there about agency leadership particularly. And finally, many agency owners come to me to talk about account management training, but actually the 3 big outcomes that they really want from the training are to answer the following 3 questions. How can I have more predictable client retention and revenue from existing clients? How can I hardwire these commercial skills into the business and ensure I have a repeatable process that everyone can follow in the agency, so that if that person leaves, everybody else knows what to do when it comes to account retention and growth? And also, finally, how can I foster a more commercial mindset, which will give me a competitive advantage in the marketplace? So if any of those 3 outcomes resonate with you, please check out my Account Accelerator program, which is on my website. It is a 1-year coaching and training program, and it's designed for those who are working in an agency, managing the client relationship, and they are responsible ultimately for the growth of that account. So if this sounds of interest, you can go to my website, accountmanagementskills.com, and check out the details of my Account Accelerator. I look forward to speaking to you on the next one.